Moving Iron Podcast is proud to be part of the Global Ag Network. The network is live, so check out globalagnetwork.com for more details and updates. Now on to the show.
Moving Iron in the 21st century. Hardworking people working hard for you and me. Moving Iron time and time again.
Hello and welcome to Moving Iron Podcast number 131 with my guest, Damon Mason. Damien, how are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me here, Casey. This is an honor and a privilege. I appreciate it.
It's very much an honor and privilege for me because you're the first guy that actually sent me a book that I didn't have to pay for, so I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you having me because your audience needs to hear about this because I get the idea that many of your audience are going to be attending the Moving Iron Summit in Nashville, and I'm going to be on stage talking to them, and I thought, well, then why not make sure that you, Mr. Seymour, have a copy of the Do Business Better book because we'll be being breaking references from the Do Business Better book to them while we're in Nashville.
Well, so I had a chance to read through Do Business Better, and you know, there's a lot of good stuff in there. A lot of things that I would say that people need to go and read. And it's very common sense, very easy to read type of stuff in that book. So it's not boring. It's a quick read. It's one of those things, and you're staying in tune, and you have lots of great stories. So hats off to you on your book here.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate you being a reader and a client and all those things. So whatever we can share with your listeners that they can glean something from, I don't know if any of them keep up with my stuff, since we probably have a little bit of a crowd that maybe some of them know who I am, but I'm a farm guy and I'm an ag guy, and that's my background, and now I wrote a book about business. And then there's some people that say, why don't you're an ag guy? And I said, well, let's not pretend that agriculture is not a business. You know, those big pieces of equipment that you sell, we've come a long way from the one bottom plow to right. Pull behind a horse.
Yeah.
So if you think this is not a business, obviously everybody that listens to Moving Iron knows it is, because those dollars don't come from nowhere, that come in and buy that big machinery. So this is all about business. And the Do Business Better book, while it's not an ag book, it is a business book, and there are agricultural references.
Yes, there are. There are several in there. So I read through the book, and one of the biggest overarching themes that I found when I was reading it had to do with basically, you know, being risk tolerant and being able to understand that when it's time for you to do something, to make that decision and move forward, and then be willing to, adjust on the fly. That's really kind of what I tried to give you an elevator speech on the book. That was the one thing that I took from it. So talk about your motivations about writing this book and where it comes from and your thought process in putting this all together.
Yeah, everybody has a book in them. I mean, that's been said before. There's all kinds of people. If you were sitting at the tavern, and you know, even in a small blue-collar town like where I'm from, Huntington, Indiana, you hear people like, oh, I could write a book. Like, well, actually, you can't read nor write. Sorry, pal. There's people like that. But the reality is many of us have a book within us. I've written self-published books before that I always sold in the back of the room because I make a living getting on stage and talking at corporate events. But this time for a more full-blown, I don't say legitimate, but a full-blown business-oriented book. And a friend of mine that's in the business, he actually wrote the foreword for it, and he's got several New York Times bestsellers, and he said, you know a lot about business. Why are you not just talk to these people about what you know? And then my wife said, Damien, write the book that you wish someone had given you 25 years ago when you started out. And I think a lot of people like your listeners can appreciate this, Casey. You know, I'm a blue-collar kid from a small dairy farm, average-sized dairy farm in Indiana. Lived through the 80s, and a lot of people, you know, on the farming operation know exactly what I'm talking about when I reference that. So you're a blue-collar kid. Your dad works nights on the railroad, and me and my mom and some of my siblings worked on the farm. So I've always worked. And I've always had a thing for business. You know, my mom always thought, oh, you got to go get a job. You got to get a job. And that's the way that they raised us. You know, some people are raised to be entrepreneurs. They're raised to be business owners, or they're raised to assume the family business. Well, there wasn't really much of a family business for us to assume, because 9 kids and a 60-cow dairy and 100 owned acres don't amount to a whole lot when you split it 9 ways. So I always wanted to be my own business person. And I had a corporate job that I quit when I was 25 years old to become a political comedian. So everything that I have amassed, you know, the farms that I own or the investments that I have or the lifestyle that I'm able to live came about from the very beginning of I quit my corporate job. I was still paying off my college loans, and I wanted to be self-employed. The two big driving factors for me were creativity and being more in charge of my own compensation. Now, there's a lot of folks that are listening that probably are on a commission, and they like they can be in charge of their compensation. Maybe they own their own business, and that helps them be in charge of their compensation. I worked for corporate, and they gave me a raise or a few $1,000 bonus. Well, that's nice, but you're not really in charge of your compensation. I guess I like the idea that it's on me. So 25 years ago, I took the plunge. I quit corporate America, and my business was selling political comedy shows. I was a political comedian. I had just started out, didn't have a whole lot going on, had three gigs lined up for the rest of my career when I took the plunge for $1,200 of gross revenue. So that's a nice backstory. And then everybody's listening to this saying, well, that's a neat story about you, but what about me? Well, you either sink or swim. And I didn't have this whole thing, as you and I talked about before we started recording, Casey, where a lot of folks, they analyze and analyze and analyze and analyze, and I'm going to make this decision, or we're going to start this business. We just got to gather some more data. And after 1 year, after 18 months, after 24 months, you're just putting off the decision. You're just putting off the whole thing. You don't need any more data. Now, people say, well, you kind of shoot from the hip. Yeah. Well, you were young and single. Yeah, I did all that. But people say that's excuses. You know, I would have quit my job and become a political comedian too if I was 25 and didn't have any wife and kids. Well, you were once 25 and didn't have any wife and kids, and you didn't. So let's not pretend, you know. So there's a lot of that. So the risk part of it, I guess, is the way I start the book off, Casey, by talking about risk tolerance. If you want to be successful in business, you don't need to make risk your friend. You don't need to make it to where you're never scared. But you got to be a person that can take on some degree of risk. And then the reality is, anymore in this day and age, all of us are at risk. Your dealership, you're an employee, could get bought out or closed down 3 months from now, and now you're figuring out the next thing. Right. So there's really nothing that's guaranteed for any of us.
Yep. Now, and to your point there, you know, my idea for this podcast, I've had it for 5 years before I started it. I've been doing it now for, well, may it be 2 years. So, you know, previous to that, I always had a reason why. You know, I was like, oh, well, I don't have this. I don't know how to get on a SoundCloud. I don't know how to upload my podcast. And this, there's always a reason. And one day it just clicked in my head, like, hey, you know what? If you're going to do it, do it. And there's no better time than now. Kind of figure it out how you go. And, you know, my first 130 sucked. So, you know, here, top of this is the one that works, but it's, you know, it's one of those things where you just have to just go do it. Right. And sooner or later, you're going to make that decision and you're going to sink or you're going to swim, and waiting to be perfect. Like you talk about in your book, there's a difference between being good and perfect. And I think that was one thing that stuck out to me in there that I would say, I was too worried about making sure everything was perfect before I went out and did it. And when I realized that I'm never going to be perfect at it, it really made the decision easier to move forward.
Yeah, you know, when you write a book, and I can tell you more about the actual process as you originally had asked, but since we're on the subject of perfection and better, every one of us has a level of fear. You know, and I'm not some rah-rah motivational speaker. You know, I'm not Joel Osteen out here. We must overcome our fear. I'm not getting religious on you. Everybody has that. And you can say, well, you know, Damien over here, he just goes and does that. Yeah, and I look at people, and I use the example in the book. I think I'm a risk taker because I've always started my own thing, tried my own thing. I put money at risk, become a comedian. Hell, I didn't have any training to do any of that. People don't get it. Like, oh, well, did you have? No, nobody discovered me. Nobody trained me to be a comedian. I was just a funny guy with a farm boy background, an agricultural economics degree, and a career in selling lighting fixtures. So none of that is really what holds you back. And so we're all afraid a little bit. It's just that there is that thing that becomes excuses. And they'll say if they admit they're afraid, what they maybe won't admit is they're just making up excuses. It's not bad to be comfortable. You know, a buddy of mine says, the guy that wrote the foreword to this book says, there's a bunch of people that think starting your own business is a dream. He says, hell, it's a nightmare. You know, it's not easy. Ask the guy that owns the 7 dealerships right now if every day of it's a dream. some days, yeah, the combines are rolling off the lot, and everybody's credit is actually good, and you're not upside down on any payments. That's not every day. So there's days that are not good for everybody. So we all kind of have our excuses. We all have our fear. I guess what was good for me was I just always stuck with the idea that I wanted to be in charge of my own thing. Going to the corporate events when I was just an employee, I never thought like, okay, I'm in charge. And then when you quit your job, you start working for other people doing comedy gigs, let's say, it dawns on you, you're not really in charge then either. You're still serving other clients. And that's a big point that I make, that you and I both know we all work for somebody.
Right.
Yeah. You know, we're all working for somebody at some point, because you can't just sit around and pay yourself. At least I can't. You can't. So that's a reality that sets in. But at least you're in charge of your creativity, your compensation to a certain degree, because you can work harder and actually get some fruition from it.
Yep, absolutely. All right, so let's jump into a few things that are in the book that I wanted to bring up with you. So the book is full of great lessons and stuff that you went through, and I didn't realize that you've been in 40 different movies? I didn't realize that till I read the book here. But the one thing that stuck out to me, you're on the set with Leslie Nielsen, and you're talking about you know, you ask him some advice, and you're always picking brains and trying to figure out what it is. And he said something to the effect of, if you want to be a good actor, get better. You know, it was kind of his thing. And that's I'm just kind of putting myself in your shoes there. You know, I love picking people's brains and trying to figure out what they do to be successful. And if somebody told me, well, just get better, I'm going to be kind of like, I don't know why I asked you that question, because that is the dumbest answer I've ever heard anybody give me. But it's actually pretty profound. You sit back and think about it. It's exactly right. How are you going to make yourself better than you were the day before? And I think that was a great, probably one of the best pieces of advice that I found in that book that probably was given to you at a young age.
Yeah, it was. I was about, what was it we filmed? I was 29 years old, maybe 30 years old. Leslie Nielsen, who's dead now, you know, he was being funny, but I've never lost sight of that. Well, he was being funny when he says, Mason, do you want to be a good actor? Do you want to be a successful actor? And I said, yeah. He said, I got two words of advice for you, get better. And then, you know, the people standing around laughed. I'm sure he probably told that to 100 young people over the time of his career on set. And granted, I really wasn't an actor. I never introduced myself and said, well, I'm an actor, you know. But at that point in my life, if you're getting paid to be on a set in front of the movie cameras, in front of the lights with Leslie Nielsen, by God, you're an actor. And so that really resonated with me. You go back to the trailer and, you know, get changed for your next scene, and it dawns on you, I'm an actor. So today, it's my job to get better at acting. So everybody listening to this podcast, you know what? Some days you're the chief mechanic at the dealership. Some days you're there hosting the field day. You're not a mechanic anymore unless a person asks you a mechanical question. What if they ask where the bathroom is? Now you're a tour guide. What if they ask you how things are behind the scenes at the dealerships? They're trying to get a little gossip on you. You know what you are then? You're a public relations person. What if then they ask you about this piece of machinery and say, well, you're behind the scenes. You know, you work on these things. Tell me, now you're a salesman and a consultative mechanic. You know what I mean? At everything that we do, we can all say, well, that's not my job. Or we can say, in this moment, that's my job. By God, I'm going to get better at it. Make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You got to kind of do jack of all trades sometimes to make everything kind of set up and be firm.
Casey, there's another aspect of the better part that I guess I made the point in the book, Do Business Better, that it might be a clever title, and I could have been more of a huckster and said, how to make $1 billion doing nothing, how to lay around your couch eating Funyuns and be a success. And that's a bunch of crap. I mean, I don't believe those things, and I don't fall for those things, and I am saddened when I hear people do. That's charlatan, fraud, snake oil salesman kind of stuff. I can't promise you that you're going to lay around, eat Funyuns, and be successful. But I can say, if you just take a few guiding principles from this book, some of them that I'm helping you learn from me the hard way, and also profiling, as you've already talked about some of the examples, if you just for the 3 hours it takes to read the book, let's say, if you just apply some of those lessons, I think you can get better. What if you get 20% better? Well, 20% better is pretty darn good. You know, what if it's 10% better? That's pretty darn good for any of us. Take what you earn right now, take the level of happiness you have, and say, what if I was 10% happier and 10% more revenue generating each year? That's better.
Yeah, absolutely. So One other thing that was in here that really stood out to me was you had an example of two different bulldozer operators that you had, and one was a loved to be a bulldozer operator, owned his own company, loved being a bulldozer operator, loved moving dirt, loved going out working the land, doing the whole thing. The other guy also loved being an operator, loved being in the machinery, doing all that stuff, but he also wanted to make sure his business was successful, and that in order to do that, he may have to make sure that he managed his people and managed his resources so he could do that. Talk about that dynamic when you talk to people, whether it's in the ag business sector or just in any other business sector out there. There's so many examples of that you can just go through time and time again.
There is, and you know what? It's something we can all learn from. And in the book, of course, I call it The Tale of Two Bulldozer Operators. I have employed both of them, meaning I have engaged. When you own a couple of farms, and I've owned four farms, and some of them needed fence rows cleaned out, ponds, drainage, dams, washcobs, all this kind of stuff. You do enough work over the time that certainly you get to know them. So that's the example, like you said, that one of them really runs a great bulldozer, and that's where he's comfortable. And he avoids some of the business aspects of being a business owner. His employee situation is always kind of tumultuous. There's some ducks that aren't, you know, in a row. There's clients that aren't getting called back. There are customer service problems, unhappy customer service problems. So that is the issue. The person that runs the business from where their comfort is, and that means on the seat of the bulldozer, because that's what he really is. He's a bulldozer operator that then grew and ungrudgingly had to become a business owner. And the other person said, I want to be a business owner, not a bulldozer operator. So how this relates to everybody that's listening right now, they know. Everybody right now that's listening can say, oh, God, I know that guy. I know that guy. He is amazing at selling machinery. And because he was amazing at selling machinery, he made a lot of money. And then the owner of our dealership that had three stores died and treated this guy like a son and brought him in and said, you're in charge of – he's a brilliant machinery salesperson, not a brilliant machinery dealership owner manager. I'm sure that we could use that example. Mm-hmm. We could use that example, Casey, with farmers. Now, you're not being mean, because every customer you have, every farmer that you have there at your dealership – is brilliant and does a great job in her business. But let's just say some other person's customers. Everybody probably has a customer that's amazing at their craft, at their job, at their function, meaning being a farmer. But that doesn't mean they're good at being a business person, and that's where the problem is.
Yeah, I can give you plenty of examples of amazing farmers that can grow anything out of concrete, right? They can get just amazing crops, but they're not the best business people. So but on the flip side of that, like, there's some great business people out there that are in ag that can't even touch the yield that other farmer does. So, I mean, it's a dichotomy, right? You know, it's one of those things, it's a yin and a yang. Really, do you have, you know, a perfectly sound, agronomically driven guy that's also great at business? You know, it's just, there's always one of those things that just, it's just one of those things you kind of have give and take with the other, but it's an amazing deal.
It's a real thing, and it goes to the thing of each of us wears a few hats, but the problem isn't that you wear a few hats, it's that you are hiding from the one that matters, and that's really the story of the bulldozer operator. Yeah, going out there and hiding on that machine, because that's where you're comfortable, running that machine with all that noise about you, and if that's what you're really good at doing, then you're letting other things slip through the cracks. Customer issues, customer service, unhappy customer, accounts receivable, accounts payable, you know, client relations, employee relations, whatever that thing is. But that's the big learning thing there is, I tell farm folks, if you are the person that wants to hide in the shop and pretend you're wrenching on the coulters on the planter all winter long, and to avoid being at your desk managing input costs. If you want to be just out there on a tractor working all night when you truthfully could get somebody else to probably drive that grain cart overnight, I get it. The crop has to come in. But what if you're letting business slip through the cracks because you're just doing what you love versus what needs to be done? You know, I have a showbiz background, Casey. They told me a long time ago, I went to lunch with a smart comedian. Not a very successful comedian, but a smart one. I said, I just quit my job. This is my craft now, and I'm really working hard on the business side of it. He was not a business-minded one, but he did tell me something really smart. He said, you'll find you're either a great performing comedian or you're a great writing comedian. Almost nobody is both a great writer and great performer. So it's not bad that you're one or the other, but you must, if you're a great bulldozer operator and you don't like doing the business, hire a business manager. If you're a great farmer and you know everything about the agronomics, about getting the bushels of wheat out of that acre with the least amount of input cost and least trips across the field, and you're amazing at that, good. Get a business manager as a consultant to help you run the business out.
Yep, that kind of tailors back into that work ethic that comes along with doing those things and putting the time in and getting those things done. Because you had a story in here when you were talking to your, I think it was your niece that you were talking to, and you told her she was shocked that you were a Lady Gaga fan, and that you said you weren't necessarily a Lady Gaga fan because of the music or what it was, but her backstory and how she got to be what she is now. So, you know, she had to put in some time. She put in a ton of time to get where she's at. She didn't just show up one day and just have this God-given ability to be Lady Gaga. She put in the effort. So there's a lot of that people don't realize when someone actually arrives. So talk about that and how's that fit into just the everyday world of business.
Yeah, because, you know, your listeners right now are saying, hey, well, Mr. Seymour, I tune in here because I sell machinery out here in Iowa, and we're talking about, like, our manure spreaders going to be, you know, going extinct as livestock operations, change their arrangement, and you've got a guy here talking about Lady Gaga. What in the hell is going on?
You never know what you're going to get on here. I can tell you that.
Yeah, well, the good news is we can all learn, and it's good for us to all look at other things. And that's the one point I always make. Having a comedy background, I'm an observer. To be a professional comedian is really to be a professional observer, so I observe everything. I'm observing right now that, you know, because your listeners don't realize, I can see you and you can see me. You get this big, tough guy from western Nebraska, and he just, like, is looking at me saying, what kind of a guy is a Lady Gaga fan? I'm a farm guy. And here's what's fun about this. Actually, everybody listening to this program has heard of Lady Gaga. And maybe they're a fan, maybe they're not. The way this all works is, yes, as the example I gave, my niece couldn't believe that I was a Lady Gaga fan. It was after she jumped off the roof to enter the halftime show for the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. And my niece just gushed about how she loves Lady Gaga, she's seen her concert, and how awesome and how talented she is. And she is talented. But if people want to wrongly believe that show business at her level, because she's worth like $275 million, if they think that's just because she just showed up and was lucky one day, they don't know the story behind Lady Gaga. And this is what all of us need to appreciate. Maybe you really are naturally talented at turning a wrench. Maybe you really understand machinery and you just have a mechanical mind. Because I know people like that. They can talk about the amazing part about the rotors turning this way and why that's better with this piece of equipment. Whatever. That's all good. But that doesn't mean you'll be successful until you apply it. Lady Gaga, she was accepted into music school, and she dropped out. Lady Gaga went and slept around the clubs for years, taking her keyboard with her. She knows how to play every instrument. This idea that she's just some woman that can dance and wear a meat dress, she knows how to play every instrument. She's been working on music since she was like 4 years old. She still trains, even at this point in her career, with a voice coach every week. Now, that's something, because there's a lot of people like, oh, well, her level, what? She still works with her voice coach every week that she's been with for years and years. That's dedication and work ethic. And then, of course, the point that I make is she also was a writer. She worked writing songs for the likes of Britney Spears with a songwriting production company long before you ever heard of Lady Gaga. So today we all hear of Lady Gaga, and I saw a great thing about her that's not even in the book. She has a quote that she was broke up with a boyfriend once that told her she would never make it. And she says, not only am I going to not make it, you won't be able to go into a coffee shop and not hear my music that's how big I'm going to make it. So she used her, she uses those people that, like, because we've a lot of people put us down. She used that to her, to her credit. She is a worker.
Yeah. And that, you use the example of Tom Brady in your book. You know, here's a guy that got drafted in the sixth round, and you know, he's probably the greatest quarterback that ever played the game, and he's worried every year that he's going to get cut. So he's doing everything there is in the world to make sure that he's the best possible quarterback he can be at 41 or 2 or however old he is now.
I don't know how the guy does it. You know what? I just went and got an injection in my hip, and I'm, what, you know, 7 years older than that guy, and I think, okay, I haven't been tackled by 280-pound blitzing linebackers for the last 15 years either. So the guy's amazing, but it goes down to beyond just work ethic. You know, I think it's a resilience, which I talk about in the book. There's the thing about that says, I will not be denied. And that's a big thing about being successful. You know, Lady Gaga and telling her boyfriend that when they broke up, that's more than just work ethic. That's more than just talent. That's, by God, I'm going to make it, and I'm going to show you how.
So you bring up 4 points in the book. That was my next thing. So there's 4 points that you like to talk about in here. One is risk tolerance, drive, resilience, and vision. Couldn't probably said it better myself, but if you really look at how all those things kind of play into it, talk about those 4 points and how you relate those back to what you do in business and the people that you talk with.
Yeah, well, we talked about risk a little bit already when we said, you know, when you quit your job to become a political comedian, you don't come from nothing. You're still paying off your college loans, and you've got a 3-year-old Chevy Lumina with $8,000 of debt against it. There's risk. You know? So I did that. And there's people that say, well, you were 25, and what's $8,000 of Chevy Lumina loan and, you know, $8,000 of college loan? That's a big, you know, big deal. Well, it's all relative. When you're 25 and you have 16 grand of debt and you're renting your buddy's loft, you're still at risk. And as opposed to the person that maybe farms 10,000 acres and they're at $3 million of risk each year. It's all relative. You know, commas move, but it's all relative to your situation. And you've got to never get so comfortable. I don't take the risk now that I probably once did. Everybody listening to the show is like, yeah, I don't maybe roll the dice as hard as I used to because I'm pretty comfortable. Yeah, I understand that. The risk tolerance is a big part of it. Drive is the second trait that I say that you got to have of the success traits, and that's the easiest one to learn. As I always say, there's no ambition gene. Casey Seymour doesn't work hard because he just happened to get some gene. Casey Seymour works hard and has a podcast and puts on a conference and works really hard selling machinery because that's what you, who you are. But it's not who you were born to be necessarily. It's what you made yourself. It's the easiest one to learn. Resilience. A lot of times when I have people on my own podcast, I ask them, I say, you're an entrepreneur, and they think resilience is, it's the idea that you'll just not be denied, that you'll continue to get up from the mat. The world kicks your ass. It doesn't mean to, but it does. You'll have a bad idea. You'll have a great idea that ends up flopping. You'll have a product you put out that doesn't sell. You'll invest money into a marketing initiative, and it will not pan out. The world pushes you around. And it seems that the resilience is really the big one. And then the vision, and that's where I know you were going because you said you liked that. There's lots of people that can work hard. There's lots of people that can keep getting back up off the mat. And then there's certainly people that are not afraid of the risk. And so in our businesses, we see these people. But then you say, where are you going? And that's where it's like, oh, I don't know. I like what I do. I'm like, yeah, but where are you going? And that's where the vision part comes in. Vision is, in my opinion, seeing past what nobody else can, like obstacles. You know, oh yeah, you're worried about this thing and that's what's holding you back. You're just letting that be an unnecessary obstacle. Then there's the second part of vision, and that is, what are we trying to build? And that is something that a lot of people don't have. I make the point in the book that my wife and I both can look at a pile of turds and see the Taj Mahal. We've bought, in addition to my speaking business and farms, we've bought places and built places and renovated places. We can see the Taj Mahal through the turds. What are you building? These people that are listening right now say, well, you know, I've got this machinery company. Well, where does it go? Where can it go? And the big one there, Casey, is there a group that's not being served? Rather than looking at your competition, what's the future look like? Because most people just have a hard time. They just keep looking at what's right before them as opposed to what's down the road 3 to 5 years.
And that's one thing about the business that I'm in. We're always looking ahead, and you have to have I can't stress enough how much vision you have to have. You can read all this stuff, you can look at all the data, you can, you know, play the guessing game and all this other stuff. I didn't guess that there was going to be, you know, two epic blizzards in my area within 30 days, and that the eastern side of the state that I'm in was going to be an epic flood, you know, 100-year floods, and all of everything that's going on out there. But, you know, start looking at the big picture, you know, autonomy, you know, self-driving tractors and those kind of things. You know, I got a bet with a guy I work with that 5 years from now we're going to be trading in our first fully autonomous vehicle. And, you know, most people think I'm crazy when I start talking about that, but I don't think so. I think it's going to be such a rapid, just take off so rapidly that there's not going to be anything to stop it.
I don't think you're wrong at all. And I guess, remember, a lot of folks don't have vision because they have employee mentality. And it's not bad to be an employee. It can be bad to have an employee mentality, meaning I'm just going to show up here and do the bare minimum to get my paycheck, and I don't care what happens tomorrow. That is an employee mentality that is really, really bad for your company and for you, because at some point you've got to buy into the vision and hope that your company that you work for as an employee is newly positioned. You know, you and I can both talk about all kinds of companies that go kaput, Sears. If you were an employee at Sears, granted, you're just checking out, you know, tough skin jeans, you can't do a whole hell of a lot about it. What about a smaller company where you can help drive the vision, like you are there in Western Nebraska, and saying, you know what I see? I mean, I can tell you my own vision. I'm sure it agrees with yours. Autonomous machinery is coming. It's going to take a little while. There's a lot of kinks to be worked out. I actually tell my agricultural people, I don't see machinery getting a lot larger. Because we're already pretty damn big, and it gets to where the compaction and the field size will not hold, or, you know what I mean? That'll be the limiting factor. It won't be bigger. In fact, it might even downsize a little bit to become autonomous.
Yeah. Right there with you, man. When I look at autonomy, first off, you can't get anything much bigger than what it already is, because just the transportation, I mean, holy shit, you're driving stuff from point A to point B, and you got a four-wheel drive tractor with duals or sometimes triples on it, and it's as wide as the road, both lanes, and you're trying to figure out how to go across the bridge. And there's always that YouTube video out there this time of year where there's a guy that's got half the tractor up on the side of the bridge going across the bridge, you know, and then he comes down the other side, you know, and that kind of stuff, it becomes a hazard, right? Mm-hmm. And as that stuff grows and gets bigger, then you start talking about weights and how it affects the roads and everything else. Those kind of things start playing a factor. I'm in the same camp as you are. Once no one has to drive it, put 10 machines out there with 6-row planters instead of one machine with 60 rows. You know what I mean? It's just, it makes more sense. You know, it's just one of those things.
A great comparison. I'm talking to you right now on my Mac laptop AirBook, and it is more powerful and can do 10 times the function that my desktop that I finally got rid of 7 years ago could do. Now, you're saying, well, you're talking about computers and we're talking about trying to get the crop in and out of the field. I understand. But that's the same concept, and I see machinery. My vision for the future is less farmers, more autonomous machinery, smaller machinery, and of course, this gets some people really scared, and I say, I think we're going to probably have more contractual arrangement because of the cost of the capital that's required. If we've done that in poultry and in pork where it's on a contractual arrangement, will it eventually happen in wheat, corn, soybeans, beef, dairy, everything where there are large, large integrators that you work on behalf of, and you say, well, then I'm not really a self-employed farmer. Well, you're a farmer that's got a guaranteed contract, and I think that's going to happen because of the cap requirements. I'm not wishing it. It's just what I see happening.
Yeah. So I've been watching a lot of your speeches here of late, so I can kind of get an idea of what you're going to be talking about when it comes time for the Movie 9 Summit. But one of the biggest things that I see happening right now, and you bring it up in there, is that, you know, you talk about how, you know, we were always going to be the breadbasket of the world. We're going to export all this stuff out, yada, yada. And, well, in order for the seed companies to grow their market share, they had to go outside of the United States and teach the rest of the world how to farm. And to your point, I've been giving that some thought, the idea that the U.S. farmer is going to be way more driven to the contractual side and doing that specific something that's going to be completely different than what maybe their neighbor's doing or somebody else is doing, but they're going to grow whatever, organic wheat, or they're going to grow blue corn or whatever it might be. I mean, that's going to be the niche that's going to save, you know, the U.S. farming economy, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, in fact, it might be an uncommoditization, which means we'll just be not doing every single field up and down the road isn't going to be the same, you know, corn and soybeans. And people think that's going to be bad, and you're going to be working on a contractual arrangement. That may not be bad at all, because it'll bring diversification, and it might be the very thing that keeps that guy down the road and his wife and his kids on that ground, because they'll be doing, yeah, we only farm 800 acres, and my wife does have a job in town, but you know what? We do all blue corn for flour tortillas, and it actually has to have this, this, and this done to it. That's all fine. It's just the movement of the marketplace. Truth is, this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, and it's one of those ever-evolving things, and to your point, in that speech I was watching, is if we're not evolving to those agricultural needs, and we're doing the exact same thing that's, you know, we're just trying to out-bushel Brazil or out-bushel, you know, five of the, like your example of the five largest wheat-producing countries that are out there, you know, I mean, Australia, India, Uzbekistan, you know.
Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, there's three stand countries in Australia and India, and so maybe it's Ukraine, but either way, or Russia. So, yeah, you throw a couple of stands, Australia, India, and a Ukraine, a Russia in there, we're out of the wheat game. We're not really, but we don't get back.
It's just they can do a lot more stuff from an environmental standpoint. I mean, from environmental standards, not Australia, but we're talking like the stand countries and you know, what happens in Ukraine, those kind of things. It's a different ball game. They play under different rules. They play whole different concepts that they play within. And they just, it's just part of being in it. You know, I mean, there's things that they can do that we can't. And it's going to be an issue down the road that we have to address.
Yeah, and also what might end up happening, and, you know, again, we talk about vision, because it's very important for our business. If I was a machinery person and all I thought was how much bigger can I get and how much bigger can I make the machinery, I would think I was going down the wrong path. Or I will tell you what, they wouldn't think that, because that's what they're thinking. I would say that about them. I'd say, no, I think the future isn't about bigness. I think it's about mobility. And that's going to be a big thing that shapes your industry. And then of course, there's going to be less farmers. So right now, the reality is, There's what, you know, 2 million farms and 3 million farmers and all that. But how many of them really are buying and selling equipment? You know, I'm a farmer on paper, and I have a 50 horsepower Kubota utility tractor, and I'm not going to be buying a lot of machinery. So on paper, there's this many farmers. Really, your industry is basically consists of about 400,000 actual customers.
That's probably, yeah.
You know, and of those 400,000, pretty likely that we'll see them be cut in half in the next 10 years, not because of any bankruptcies or any of that. It really just become the marketplace will move that way because of autonomous machines.
And a lot of the stuff we see happening now with farm reductions has nothing to do with people going out of business. I'm seeing nothing, and there is some of that going on. But the majority of it is the farm's just not big enough to support son and daughter coming back to run the farm, and then also support dad when he retires. You know, so dad's barely making it with the one income that way, and then you throw basically three back on top of that. It just gets hard, and that's what you're starting to see happen, and you know, it's just part of it. You know, they just...
Well, you said, Casey, we're starting to see it. The reality is that's kind of been the story since about the Industrial Revolution. You know, man and wife moved to town and worked in a factory, and neighbor farmer and his wife bought their place and doubled. You know, I did a gig for the dairy people in January, and I pointed this out, that while the dairy thing's in a bad place right now, this has been our story for 30 plus years. There's been too much milk for 30 plus years, and we still have the number of cows. And I said, everybody acts like there's all these factory farms, but you know what? There were dairy operations when I was a kid that went from 60 cows to 120 cows. And that is a 100% increase, a doubling in a year's time. And nobody called them factory farms back then. But now, if a 1,000 cow dairy becomes a 2,000 cow dairy, oh my God.
Right.
It's been the natural flow of things. It's not that you or I are insensitive to the people that are changing their livelihood. It's just been the flow of things. It's probably going to accelerate, to be honest. And that's just because we can do so much more with so much less because of machinery and technology.
And I, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here when I say this, but you know, if you're in the equipment business right now, and we're trying hard to figure this out and working hard every day to get to that next level, but you need to face the fact that you're selling software inside of a tractor, and however that works and how you make that work, it's going to come to the point where the tractor is almost as a side effect of what you're going to do with the different efficiencies that you're going to gain from autonomy and mapping and all that different stuff. So it's just you got to figure that part out and be ready for the future.
I hadn't even thought of that because, remember, you're closer to machinery. You touch it every day. I'm around it somewhat. But, really what you're saying is the tires, it goes to this whole thing of there's the cost of entry. Hey, you know what? You're pretty good at this. That's the cost of entry. The tires, the horsepower, the steering wheel, the cab with air conditioning and satellite radio, that becomes the cost of entry because everything will have that, right? Those are function at that point. Everybody, you better have that team and show up at the ball game. Now it's what else do you have? And like you said, is it going to be the software, the technology?
Yeah. No, I think it's just a never, ever evolving game that we got to stay in front of. And I think your book points that out pretty regular, on a pretty consistent basis there. So, you know, I think that you hit the nail on the head with your book there.
I know you said you might use video, so for those that are watching still, the book is called Do Business Better. It's published by Wiley. It was written by me. It's Traits, Habits, and Actions to Help You Succeed. I do promise you, not that you can lay around your couch eating Funyuns in your bathrobe all day and be successful, but I do promise you if you apply some of the lessons, the ideas, the insights from this book, you will be better with your business in your life. You know, because everybody says, oh, well, Damien, I don't own my own business. Is this for me? That's why we keep talking about a life and business by choice, because there's lessons in there that even an employee or even an unemployed person can apply to their life.
All right. So now you've got two different podcasts that you do. One is the Business of Agriculture and one is the Do Business Better podcast based around the principles in the book and the guests that come on are all business related entrepreneur type people. So let's start with the Business of Agriculture and what's that podcast about and how's it work?
Yeah, well, you were a guest. Thank you very much. You probably will be again. The Business of Agriculture was begun 2 years ago with the idea that I think agriculture is already inundated with enough old AM farm radio. Hey, did you see what corn did? Looks like corn moved up 3 cents. As I point out all the time, I listen to rural radio sometimes. If I had Marlon Bowling's job, I would take the 9mm and swallow a bullet after the first day on the job.
Okay.
Because, and everybody's saying, oh, my God, he just – yes, I did. And I'll tell you why. If I had to spend 5 hours every day trying to pretend I were excited about a 1.5 cent move on the June corn price, I would be suicidal. So in my podcast, I said we're not going to talk about grain charts and we're not going to talk about the weather. Agricultural people are obsessed about the weather. You know what? You got it on your phone. Pull up NOAA, look at the radar, boom, you got it. So on our podcast, we talk about the business of agriculture, issues, ideas, insights, what we see. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says we got to do something about factory farming, what the hell does that mean exactly? We talk about somebody like, you know, Casey Seymour and say, what trends are you seeing in machinery and what's the actual takeaway from that? Well, he's taking it, here's the insight, here's the observation, what's it mean, boom. So that's what we do in the Business of Agriculture. Then in February, I launched the Do Business Better podcast because I'm doing more presentations to not agricultural crowds. So I've got the book Do Business Better and created the podcast Do Business Better, geared to entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, small business people, business owners, folks that want to be business owners or small business people, or people like you that just keep up with business stuff, even though you wouldn't call yourself a business owner, but you kind of are because you have your own podcast, you guys have your stuff going. We wanted to keep that one where it's sharp, good, quick interviews and getting like, what do you do? What things are important to you? What traits do you have? What habits do you have? And I love it because we talk to folks like, here's the one thing that I learned my first year. Here's the one thing that I screwed up. I ask people, where'd you screw up? Where'd you steer the ship wrong? And that's very telling because anybody that actually has been through a few wars, if they're honest, can learn a ton from those.
Yep. Now our motto we have, around the office there is fail fast. So I think there's a lot of ideas in that. And I kind of learned this through being in this industry, and as fast as things change, that there's an 80-20 rule. And the 80-20 rule is you figure out 80% of it and get moving, and then you figure out the other 20% as you're taking a little slack there. So you gotta keep moving things forward. And you said it well in your book. You can't be perfect. You're never gonna be perfect. And if you're trying to be perfect, you're never gonna get there. You're never gonna start. So I think that's a good lesson to learn.
Everybody that says I don't have this right, you know, I had a neighbor in my first farm I owned that was a carpenter, and his house was not, he had half his house that was just plywood, it was just particle board. I'm sure it's all rotted by now, and I'm sure it's because he had such issues in his head, he just knew he couldn't do it until it was perfect. Now, the reality is, would you rather drive by and, if you were the neighbor, would you rather let that house be sited somewhat imperfectly? Maybe the corners are not exactly 90 degrees, or maybe the siding is, you know, just slopes by an eighth of an inch from one side of the house to the other. Would you rather see that or rotted particle board? So the point of that is, get your house sited, whether it be perfectly or imperfectly. It's better to have it imperfectly sited than to have it perfectly kind of concepted and still just particle board after 12 years in the rain. It's the same thing for all of us. We know we know we're saying, oh, well, I'm not quite ready. It's time to go. It's time to do it, you know?
Absolutely. Well, Damien, we've been going here for a while, and this has been a great, great time, and I really appreciate the fact that you let me send me a copy of this book. We had a chance to talk about it and learn a lot of good stuff from it. So if folks want to reach out to you and maybe hire you to be a speaker or just shoot you a note, maybe get your opinion on something, how would they do that?
Well, I'm on social media, and you and I both keep up there. At Damien P. Mason is my Twitter handle. Damien Mason Professional Speaker is my Facebook page. Like me there. I put up good videos all the time. Damien Mason on LinkedIn, and then Damien, D-A-M-I-A-N, Mason, like a bricklayer.com is the best way. You can find all of my stuff there, and then there's videos on YouTube, etc. DamienMason.com. I'd love to hear from anybody, and I do very much appreciate having me on. You let me talk about my book. You let me talk about my opinions. You let me talk about agriculture, and here it is. It's the end of the day, so we did it.
Well, I think it's time for a nice glass of whiskey and a cigar.
You know what? I'll have a beer and a cigar. You have the whiskey, and we'll be doing it in spirit. Thank you.
I dig it. All right, Bubba. Well, we'll catch you next time, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Casey.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Moving Iron Podcast, now part of the Global Ag Network. If you'd like to continue any of these conversations, you can hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Moving Iron LLC. You can also send me an email at Moving Iron Podcast at MovingIronPodcast.com. You can also visit the Moving Iron Podcast YouTube channel and watch Market Roundup with Chip Mellinger, Sean Hackett, and Angie Setzer. Also, Tax News with Glenn Birnbaum. Please visit MovingIronLLC.com. Here you can find information, details, and updates for the 2019 Moving Iron Summit in Nashville, Tennessee. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can leave a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, and GlobalAgNetwork.com. So until next time, let's go move some iron. This is Casey Seymour, out.
Moving iron in the 21st century. Hardworking people working hard for you and me. Time and time again, through the years you'll find us here. Move